It's complicated. And this is something that I learned from Tony. If there's something I don't know, I say that. I don't pretend to be the official historian forever and ever. You know, I can answer questions and I can, you know, point people to more information, but I don't want to be the owner of his legacy because that's, you know, he was so much bigger than me, so much bigger than any one person.
Hi, everyone. You are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, and I'm your host, Carrie Diamond, coming to you from Newsstand Studios at Rockefeller Center in the heart of New York City. Few people knew the world of Anthony Bourdain as well as writer Laurie Wollever. As his longtime assistant, or lieutenant, as he called her, and co-author, Laurie was enmeshed in the details of his life and work. When the beloved chef and journalist died in 2018, Laurie lost a boss, a friend, and a trusted collaborator. As she grieved with the rest of the world, Laurie set about finishing a project that she and Anthony had just barely kicked off, a book that would share insider details on the places he had loved and visited over the years. That book, World Travel, An Irreverent Guide, is out now, and it's a tribute to the man who celebrated the richness of the world around us, mostly through the lens of food. I'm so honored that Laurie joins us today to talk about her life, her career, and of course, Anthony Bourdain. Today's show is presented by Homemade, the podcast from the folks at All Recipes. It's been said that a recipe is a story that ends with a good meal. The Homemade podcast celebrates this notion, serving up beloved dishes and the stories behind them. Join Marty Duncan, who was a finalist on the show Next Food Network Star, as she talks with celebrated cooks, including Guy Fieri, Patti LaBelle, and our beloved Barefoot Contessa, Ina Garten, about the memories and traditions behind their favorite foods. Listen to Homemade on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The latest guest on Homemade is the powerhouse Ayesha Curry. On top of being an entrepreneur, restaurateur, and mom, Ayesha is the co-founder of Eat, Learn, Play, an organization committed to ensuring children have nutritious food, a quality education, and a safe place for sports and activities. Marty chats with Ayesha about her latest book, The Full Plate, and shares ideas for quick, flavor-forward meals. Don't miss Ayesha and Marty in conversation. Give a listen to Homemade. Our other sponsor today is Cake Bread Cellars, the Napa Valley Winery. Since the founding of Cake Bread Cellars in 1973, they've set out to create quality wines that pair best with good food and good company. And that is my favorite kind of wine. Some suggested sips for now. How about Cake Bread Cellars 2020 Van de Porch Rosé from Anderson Valley, a favorite of mine and of Cake Bread Cellars winemaker, Stephanie Jacobs. Van de Porch, no accent required, is a traditional dry rosé, and true to its name, it's meant to be enjoyed on the porch or patio, says Stephanie. Pinot Noir grapes give this wine delicate aromas of strawberry and bright, refreshing acidity. Or there's the 2018 Chardonnay Reserve. According to Stephanie, for every vintage of Cake Bread Cellars Chardonnay Reserve, they select the finest lots from their four estate vineyards in the Carneros region of Napa Valley. Stephanie describes this wine as the quintessential expression of cool climate Carneros Chardonnay with concentrated flavors of creamy golden apple, ripe peach, and baking spices, supported by pitch-perfect acidity. To learn more about Cake Bread Cellars, visit cakebread.com. And ask for Cake Bread Cellars at your favorite wine shop or look for it on your favorite delivery service. We've got a little housekeeping from Cherry Bomb HQ. Don't miss the latest issue of Cherry Bomb Magazine, which is all about the life and legacy of Julia Child. Yes, we have a print magazine and it is a beautiful magazine, if I say so myself. The Julia issue is filled with some never-before-seen archival photos, classic Julia recipes, and essays about Julia's enduring influence. This issue is a fresh take on a big personality who continues to resonate culturally and culinarily. Visit cherrybomb.com to snag your copy or to subscribe. Enjoy today's interview. Laurie Wollever, welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We have a lot to talk about. You have a brand new book that's out right now called World Travel, An Irreverent Guide, and it's a fantastic book.
Thank you.
You are working on a biography of Anthony Bourdain that will be out in the fall. But Before we talk about all that, I want to talk about you, because I do feel like you get a little lost in the world of Anthony Bourdain, which is understandable. He was larger than life, but you have had a fascinating career. And like I mentioned, you are a terrific writer.
Thank you.
And have a great take on things, as folks who listen to your podcast know. So I wanted to start at the very beginning, Lori. Where are you from?
I am from a small village called Chittenango, which is outside of Syracuse. So upstate, kind of right in the center of the state. And yeah, that's where I grew up. It's the birthplace of L. Frank Baum, who wrote The Wizard of Oz. And that's probably the most famous thing about it. But it's very small little town where I grew up. And
you called it a village. Was it really a village?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that's the, it's incorporated as a village.
Okay.
Yeah. So
okay.
It's in a larger town, but yeah, the village of Chittenango. I think it's about population 5,000 or so.
And I know there were stops in between, but you went to culinary school.
I did.
Did you want to be a chef or a writer or combine them both?
I guess both. You know, I always wanted to be a writer. And when I got out of college, I felt like, well, I don't actually know anything. You know, I had my academic training, which was in natural resources management. And I figured out pretty quickly that that wasn't what I wanted to do with my career. And I knew how to cook a little bit, just sort of self-taught from cookbooks. But
okay, wait, I have to drag you back.
Oh, sure.
So you went to Cornell, which you didn't even mention. Mm. So you're not bragging about going to an Ivy League school. And what was that major?
So it was in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. And it was, I think, largely designed for people who were going to work for New York State or for the federal government on some level, you know, managing state parks, managing wildlife populations, you know, working with hunters and fishermen or working with, you know, municipalities to set ordinances. I mean, very important, but very dry work. And I was not by any stretch a scientist. I chose that major because I liked camping and going to like music festivals. And I liked being around like hippies. You know, this was the...
Wait, literally, that's how you picked your major.
More or less. Yeah. I actually started out in communications because I wanted to be a writer. And I quickly was like, it was much more about PR. And again, about sort of messaging for the agricultural field. And I thought this is not what I want to do. You know, I might as well do this other thing where all the cool kids are. Maybe I'll get some rides to some dead shows and, you know, a weed hookup and that'll be really cool.
Were you a hippie back in the day?
I was.
Wow.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I went to college at SUNY Plattsburgh. Mm. I applied to Cornell, did not get in, but went to SUNY Plattsburgh. And I was shocked as a kid from New York City because everybody was a hippie except me and my three friends.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, I don't know, a time and a place thing.
It was, if you weren't into the dead and smoking pot, you were pretty lost.
Mm, yeah, I can see up there, so far north up there too. It's like all about being outdoors. And so this was what I studied and it was fine. I mean, I learned some things, but I was, you know, not by any stretch a scientist. I struggled with chemistry. I struggled with math. But I love the ethics part of it and the philosophy part of it. But I went right to work at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, thinking I would do kind of a, you know, an urban gardening thing. And again, was like, oh, I hate this. Like, you know, I love gardening. I love being outdoors and doing that kind of stuff, but not as a job, you know, making very little money and sweating my ass off and, you know, mowing lawns and pitching straw and just, you know, picking up garbage on Flatbush Avenue. Like just not, it wasn't where I wanted to be as a recent college graduate who had just moved to New York City.
Did you want to be in the city though? Had that been a goal?
Yes, definitely. So it was good to have a job to arrive to. And you know, I rented an apartment over the phone, sight unseen. Also not great. It was in a basement in like Kensington, you know, and I felt like I was like, I'm in the suburbs of Chicago or something. Like what? I don't even feel like I'm living in New York, you know, and I'm basically working on a farm. I'm not doing New York right here. Like I moved into the East Village and got a job as a cook with a family who were just looking for someone to cook very simple, low fat food.
Were you qualified for that job?
Not really. No, I mean, I didn't think so, but I think what was important to them was that I had been to college and that I could hear and understand what they wanted, which was, you know, plain pasta and sauce from a jar and steamed vegetables and, you know, broiled chicken. This was like mid-90s, still very much about like the low-fat thing. So there were a lot of snack wells. There were a lot of every iteration of fat-free sweets. You know, it was very much a time capsule. They had hired somebody before me who was like a classically trained French chef, and they had to fire her because she was like, I'm not going to not use butter, you know? And that was not what they wanted out of their cook. So
that's so funny.
Yeah. So I did that and, you know, but I wanted to write. I was taking classes already, sort of, you know, continuing ed classes at NYU or the New School to continue writing. And I thought, well, let me try and make a go of this cooking thing. And then I'll have a subject matter. I'll have some facility with it. And then I can also, you know, use those skills to actually support myself, because the dream of supporting oneself as a writer is, you know, it is very difficult. So I went to cooking school.
Did you have any restaurant experience?
At that point, I had been a bus girl in the best restaurant in Chittenango, which was called Cop's Canteen Family Restaurant. And it was very good. And so I spent some time as a bus girl, and that was really the extent of it. Oh, actually, that's not true. The summer before college, I worked at the golf club in the next town over, and I ran the hot dog stand on the ninth hole.
We have that in common.
Oh.
In high school, I worked on a hot dog truck.
Okay.
Before hot dog trucks were cool. Sadly.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was cooking hot dogs on a grill, you know, again, dressed like a hippie. And my sleazebag boss was like, you know, if you wear a bikini, you probably get bigger tips.
No.
And I'm like, I'll stick to my very modest Land's End tank suit and my crystals and my Teva sandals. Thank you very much.
That's gross.
Yeah, it was gross, but very, very in keeping with the restaurant business.
Oh, yeah. As you would come to learn, as we all would come to learn.
Yes.
Okay. So you decide to go to culinary school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What happened next?
So I went to French Culinary Institute here in Manhattan, and that was a 6-month program. And, you know, like many things that I tried at first, I was like, oh, I hate this too. I think what I realized is I love cooking, and I knew that I wasn't just constitutionally, I wasn't cut out to be a restaurant cook, but that I was, you know, willing to get this training. And if I had to do it for 6 months to kind of get my foot in the door and establish some credibility, I would do it. But I always knew that this was not the life I wanted for myself. I respect it. I admire it. Part of me wanted it because it was, you know, fun and exhilarating. But I just knew, like, I emotionally, physically, constitutionally, this was not, you know, where I wanted to hang my hat. So as soon as I graduated from culinary school, I did a couple of trails. At that time, this was, you know, 1998, 99, they were paying like maybe $8 an hour. Like, that was probably the top rate for an entry-level cook. And it was, you know, shift pay and no benefits and just, you know, the way that we know the restaurant business was and in some ways continues to be. I did a couple of trails, didn't love anything. And then I interviewed to be Mario Batali's assistant. And I think I was the only person who interviewed, because at that time he just wasn't quite the known quantity that he became. He did have a show on the Food Network, but it just, the Food Network wasn't then what it became either. It was still pretty niche. So I interviewed, I said the right things that impressed him, and I was willing to take the very low salary, and I got the job. And I did that for 3.5 years.
I forgot you worked for Mario.
Mm-hmm. For quite a long time. Yeah. Which was a real education in everything, you know, restaurants, cooking, wine, Italy, travel, you know, business, press and media. You know, this was like 6 months after Babbo had opened. They had already gotten this great New York Times, I think, 3-star review, and they were on track to win the James Beard Best New Restaurant Award in 1999. So it was this incredibly exciting time to be at, you know, arguably the hottest restaurant in New York for a while, you know, with this very up-and-coming chef and, you know, people who had come from Gramercy Tavern, a lot of them, or, you know, from Poe and from Joe Bastianich's restaurants. And so people who were really excited about hospitality, doing this new thing, working at the top of their game. I mean, I felt very, very lucky to be there.
And you worked on Mario's cookbook, right?
I did. So the first one that I worked on was called Holiday Food, which is just a little kind of maybe, I don't know, 65 recipe Christmas book that that was fun and a good sort of intro project. And then really the bulk of my time there was working on the Babbo cookbook, which published shortly before I was done working there. And that was an incredible education in all of the things that come together to make a cookbook.
What are some of the things you learned? Cookbooks are hard.
Yeah, especially restaurant cookbooks. And that was definitely the paradigm at that time. You know, the things that were getting published and getting a lot of notice were restaurant cookbooks. And I think, I don't know how many of them hold up. You know, I think it's very difficult. It's just two different styles of cooking, restaurant cooking and home cooking. And I think we tried our best to make these recipes work and be accessible. I've heard good things that people still like the cookbook. I'm sure it's got a lot of flaws that I'd rather not, you know, revisit at this time. But, I learned the process of talking to chefs and cooks and, you know, working. They have this, you know, kitchen Bible that has different names in different restaurants, but most restaurants, I believe, still have like a binder with the recipes, you know? And so I learned a lot about scaling down and making substitutions and how to, you know, there were some cases where it was just real dumb to make like a caramel on the stovetop just to caramelize, you know, a head of fennel when it's like, you can just do that in the oven, you know? You know, all of that process of making something work for a home kitchen, you know, all of the work, all of the back and forth that goes on between, you know, a publisher and an author, you know, the whole process of choosing a photographer, of setting all of that up, all the work and all of the time and effort and, you know, waste that goes into a restaurant photo shoot for a book. You know, all the many, many people. I mean, there's always generally one name or maybe two on the cover of a book, but truly the hugely collaborative process of putting something like that together, that was all new to me and very exciting.
And that, if I remember correctly, served as your introduction to Anthony Bourdain.
That's right. That's right. So in the time that I was working for Mario, Tony wrote and published Kitchen Confidential, and he and Mario became friends just by virtue of being kind of in this, you know, same business and same level of celebrity in New York. And so when it came time for me to leave, stop working for Mario, I gave him a very long notice. And, you know, I wanted to really leave in a very positive way. So he knew I was leaving for like a year. And at some point, Tony asked him if he knew anyone who could help him with his book. He had his first cookbook, Anthony Bourdain's Layal cookbook. He was looking for someone to do recipe editing and testing like I had done for the Babbo book. And so Mario very generously introduced us. And so that's how I first got to know Tony, was by, you know, he hired me to help out with that book.
Why were you leaving Mario? What was your plan professionally?
I didn't have a strong plan. I was really tired. And I could see that, you know, like what I couldn't, the path that was available to me wasn't one that I wanted. You know, I could either stay an assistant for a long time, which was starting to become very exhausting. And I felt like I was starting to age out of that particular type of assistant job. You know, he offered me a path into management in the restaurants, which didn't appeal to me. I had no front of the house experience. And
I don't see you as wanting to be a restaurant manager.
Yeah, it just didn't make sense for me. And I just felt like, okay, well, I think my time is done here. And, you know, I really wanted to be a writer. And I had started writing freelance, you know, food and travel pieces for various outlets. And I wanted to have more time and energy to devote to that. But I didn't have a real game plan as far as like, how will I support myself? And what I ended up doing was working as a private cook and picking up catering gigs and just kind of patching stuff together and going into like a significant amount of debt at the same time.
Oh, no. 'Cause
it was not that easy to, you know, just to make money.
And you have a son.
I do.
When
yes.
did you have your baby?
He was born much later. He was born in 2008.
Okay.
So I was unmarried. And then in that period of time, you know, met my now ex-husband and got married and had a baby. But
so we can cover that.
Sure.
In a few.
Yeah.
Well, we have a few years to go through before we get to that. When did you work at Wine Spectator?
So that was, I started in 2006, had been working at Art Culinaire magazine before that, and which was a great experience, but I was ready to start working in Manhattan again and just kind of have a closer to home kind of thing. You know, I was commuting 4 hours a day to get back and forth to Morristown, New Jersey. And that, you know, that gets a little old. So I started in 2006 and I was there full-time until 2009. And then I continued on as a contributing editor until 2014.
And how did wine become a particular subject of expertise for you?
I don't know that it ever did. I think I got a real general, broad education in wine from working there. Certainly, you know, everyone, when they first start at the company, takes an intro wine course, you know, off premises. The company pays for you to go, and it's a series of evenings for a couple of weeks. And that was great. That really was a jump start, because I really didn't know much about wine, except that I really liked to drink it. And I had learned a fair bit about Italian wine from working with Mario, but I needed a more broad and comprehensive education. So there were a couple of tracks at Wine Spectator. I think you could really focus in with the hopes of becoming a taster or someone who had a tasting beat. And that wasn't really interesting to me. I was more generalist, and most of what I wrote and edited involved food and recipes and wine and food pairing. So that was a track that I was comfortable with. But I did, you know, just by being there, I mean, you'd be crazy not to learn as much as you can while you're there. There's just such an amazing opportunity to learn about, read about, and taste, you know, a lot of great stuff. Although I will say, I worked on the website, and, you know, there was a real divide between web and print. And, you know, web had its own floor. And so a lot of wines obviously would come in for the editors to taste. And then things, you know, every couple of weeks or whatever, there would be a giveaway of wines. And the stuff that made it down to the web floor was like, here's a Merlot from Idaho. It's real good. You know, just like, we did not get our hands on the top shelf stuff, understandably. So, you know, it was definitely a thing you had to earn to kind of be invited to the better tastings. Like the one tasting that the web staff always was obligated to attend was the Beaujolais Nouveau tasting, which was fine.
Why are you laughing?
Well, you know, it was just very, it was very clear, like,
where you stood.
Yeah. Like that the senior editors had no interest in tasting the Beaujolais Nouveau. And some of it was good and some of it was, you know, not.
I forgot to apologize to the wine growers of Idaho.
Yeah,
so if there are any of you out there who work at a winery in Idaho,
Yeah, I'm sure there's some great stuff. I mean, there's wine made in all 50 states of this country, and a lot of it is probably a lot better than we all give it credit for.
I've tried a lot of regional wines in my day. Mm. Did you watch Schitt's Creek?
Yes.
Oh my God. The winery episodes. Mm-hmm. So funny. Mm-hmm. I just finished that series.
Oh, so good.
And I feel like my best friends moved across country.
It was very, very sad, the ending. But you can always just start back at the beginning.
That's true. That's true. Okay. So Bourdain gets in touch, mm-hmm. or Mario connects you to mm-hmm. work on the Leal mm-hmm. cookbook. Mm-hmm. What did that involve?
So that was, again, you know, working with the chefs and the cooks at the restaurant, mostly from a remote standpoint, a lot of email. They would send me the kitchen recipe and I would scale it down and sometimes make some adjustments just to make it, you know, more practical for the home cook. But Tony really wanted it to be a bistro cookbook, you know, something that you could, if you were, you know, if you had your own similar place in another part of the country, you could pick it up and get a lot of great ideas and replicate this stuff.
So he wanted the book to be for restaurant people. He wasn't looking for it to be the ultimate bistro cookbook for the home chef.
Well, I think it was important that it be executable by a home cook, but he didn't want it sort of softened on the edges in any way. I mean, there's great stories about him, you know, it's printed on this very rough stock, which apparently the photographer was very unhappy about because it doesn't, you know, it wasn't the style at the time. And now I think it is a little more, but, you know, the cover is made out of butcher paper. And, you know, his idea was that he wanted it to get greasy in the kitchen. He wanted it to feel like a cookbook that you would touch with your hands and that would really soak up all the, you know, the stains and the whatever, the sauce splashes from your kitchen. So I think in that way, you know, he didn't want it to be like, well, here's the sweet, you know, gentle housewife version of whatever it is. You know, I mean, there are some challenging recipes in there. There's a cassoulet, there's a tripe dish, there are, you know, things that take a couple of days. And then there are some, you know, much simpler, you know, salads and steaks and, you know, things that are sort of a la minute, but it's very true to the food that they were serving at Leal.
Is there anything you make from that cookbook to this day?
The roast chicken is just, you know, it's totally foolproof. If I'm feeling really ambitious, I'll do the French fries because that's a great recipe, but you know, it's a mess to make French fries at home.
That's super duper ambitious. I would never even try that. What's special about the roast chicken?
The writing around it is really funny. The head note, and Tony wrote all of those head notes. I mean, that's 100% him. He talks about how you don't really need to truss it. You can just have, there's this easy little thing where you just poke a hole in the skin and tuck the legs in. And he, you know, wrote this whole funny thing about it's, you know, it's sort of undignified looking. And there's a temperature change, which I think a lot of recipes don't have. I think it starts out, you blast it and then slow it down to sort of, you know, not burn or not dry out the breast, but just very, very simple. It's got a ton of butter under the skin. You know, it's delicious. It makes its own kind of beautiful pan sauce. And it's just, you know, now, especially not having him around, it makes me feel a little bit closer to him to make that recipe.
Was he famous at the time? I mean, Kitchen Confidential had come out and was such a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say he was famous, but not certainly at the level of fame that he achieved later in his life. Cook's Tour at that point, I think, had been on for one or two seasons. And he, I think, maybe had just published the Cook's Tour book with sort of a companion guide, and also a book called Typhoid Mary, which was sort of to very little fanfare, but is a great book. I started reading actually right at the beginning of the pandemic because it's about, you know, pandemic illness and infectious disease in New York. And it's short and really, really interesting. So he was famous, but I think he, you know, the level of events he was doing, the types of work he was doing, you know, was still at a different level of fame right. than he later achieved.
He wasn't sharing meals with presidents and other
right.
heads of state.
Yeah. Right.
What was it about him or you that you two clicked?
That's a good question. I mean, we only met in person probably twice in that whole process of working on the Leal book. I think coming from having worked for Mario, I think there was just a built-in kind of trust, you know, and I think that's the way he operated. Like in the restaurant world, you know, if a trusted chef friend sent him a cook, he would know, all right, that guy's good because that guy recommended him. So I think he trusted Mario and, you know, seeing that I had worked for Mario for 3.5 years, that I could be up to the task, you know, and I think I did good work. You know, I hit my deadlines and, you know, asked a lot of questions and, you know, I think I helped make him look good, you know? So it was for me a very fruitful, partnership and, you know, being able to work from home, not having to go into an office and, you know, that allowed me to do all the other things I was doing to try and, you know, keep my ship afloat. He never said no. If I said, you know, I need to buy this, that, or the other thing, you know, he helped me source ingredients through the restaurant. So I wasn't having to run around too much. You know, he let me buy the equipment that I needed, you know, and I didn't take advantage of it, but he just was like, whatever you need to make this a successful book, you know, you've got it. So I was really pleased because that's not always the case.
And did he ask you to keep working with him after that?
No, it was very much understood that it was that this was a project thing. So I never thought I would work with him again. I just thought that was a great experience. I'm glad to know him. I think once in a while I would send him an email. I was supposed to go to Vietnam in 2004, 2005, and I asked him for some advice, which he gladly gave me. But I just figured we would just be sort of, you know, he would just be somebody that I could use as a reference. And then actually in 2007, he asked me to help him out with a traveling event because his assistant at the time was pregnant and couldn't travel. So I did, just as a one-off, go out to Bozeman, Montana and met him there. And he had done a couple of events before I got there. And then he needed help doing an in-house dinner for like the university football coach or something. I don't know. It was a big series of events and he wanted a second pair of hands. And I was very happy to do that.
And what happened after that?
So then, you know, I went back to working for Wine Spectator and I had just gotten married. It's funny, we Tony and I got married around the same time and we had kids not too far apart. So we sort of had this point of connection around being newlyweds, you know, with kids, even though our ages are pretty far apart. So I went back to work for Wine Spectator. I got married. I had my kid. And then at some point I realized, like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be a full-time editor anymore. It was very, very difficult to go back and forth to the city, you know, pumping at work and, you know, mm-hmm. taking bags of breast milk on the subway and, you know, just all of the sort of logistical nightmares of trying to keep everything, all the balls in the air. So I started looking for a job that would give me some more flexibility. I reached out to Tony and a number of other people and said, I'm looking for part-time work. Just keep me in mind. Here's my skills. I'm willing to do whatever, you know, I can find. I just don't want to work full time anymore. Right away, he wrote back and said, you know, my assistant Beth is actually leaving. I know, you know, you're probably overqualified at this point, but would you ever consider being my assistant? And I was just like, yeah, of course. You know, I don't think I would have been just anyone's assistant. And it did feel a little strange to go from being an editor back down to being an assistant, but it was Tony, you know, and I knew that he would be a great boss. I knew it would potentially, you know, bring some great opportunities my way. And it allowed me to be home, you know, and not have to be sort of schlepping around and running myself ragged while having an infant to take care of.
And you weren't the kind of assistant we've seen in movies and TV shows where you're like at his beck and call and running behind him with a clipboard and
things
like that. You, in fact, I think I remember when we spoke on the show last time, you, in fact, didn't even see him that often.
Right. I mean, he traveled so much. And so we didn't have a shared office. Again, I really wasn't required to be any place particular. As long as I had, you know, internet access and phone access, I could kind of do my job from anywhere. And I loved it. I still sent my kid to daycare most days, you know, because kids are their own full-time job. So, but I was able to, you know, have some days with him and not stress about the subway and all of, you know, the clothes and all of the things that go along with working in Manhattan.
I'm sorry, we dragged you into Manhattan today.
Oh, no, I'm very happy to be here.
Are you? Good. Yeah. Good. What kind of work did you do for him?
At first, it was really basic kind of assistant stuff, you know, keeping his schedule and managing his time and making sure that the travel stuff all lined up and that he got to where he needed to be when he needed to be there. And fielding queries. I mean, just so many people asking for interviews, asking him to do events, asking him to do this or that. You know, a lot of questions that would come from the pre-production side of his TV show. Just, you know, it's an exhausting amount of back and forth. And so I was the catch-all for all of that stuff. And then I could make it really kind of streamlined for him and just get yes and no answers or tell him, like, these are your two options, choose one. Which just cut down on a lot of the static in his life. So, you know, it's not rocket science, but to do it in a way that relieves the stress of the person that you're working for, I think is important, you know? And then as time went on, I started to do more things like editing. You know, if he had to write something, a foreword or a chapter or an article or something, he would send it to me and I would make some edits or make some suggestions. Sometimes I ghost wrote stuff for him. And then he eventually started his imprint with Echo, Anthony Bourdain Books, and he started giving me the opportunity to get involved with that. So that I did line editing for one of the first books he published, which was called Grand Forks, which was a collection of Marilyn Haggerty's restaurant reviews from the North Dakota, from the Grand Forks Herald in North Dakota.
Tell everybody why she was famous.
She was famous because she wrote very typical for her review of the Olive Garden, somewhere in Grand Forks or the immediate area. And for some reason, it went viral. Somebody picked it up and thought it was hilarious because it was a very earnest review, straightforward review about the Olive Garden. And that was just the zeitgeist of 2011 or 2000, I think it was 2012, that this was hilarious to a lot of people. And she went viral. And of course, there was a lot of derision. And then Tony kind of came from under and was like, this is amazing. You know, like let's not make fun of this. You know, this is one of the viable restaurant choices in this area. And she's doing them the respect and the service of reviewing it, you know? And so he really saw a lot of value in what she was doing and sort of an anti-coastal snobbery approach to things. And so he really felt strongly about publishing her collected works. And she's still working, by the way. I mean, I don't know. She must be in her 90s by now, but she has been writing reviews of everything, you know, independent restaurants, McDonald's, Golden Corral, you know, the Olive Garden. I mean, she does it all high and low. And so I just immerse myself in her body of work. And it's really, you learn a lot about a place from the kinds of restaurants that people are interested in reading about in an area. So that was a great, fun project and an intro to being involved with the imprint.
Let me ask, so all along, were you still doing your own writing or was there just no time? You know, you had this demanding job, you were mm-hmm. raising a child.
Mm-hmm. I was, as much as I could, I was still doing my own writing. You know, I had this kind of steady gig as a contributing editor at Wine Spectator. So I was doing a certain number of articles a month, mostly sort of recipe-based and some, you know, I had to write quizzes and just, I mean, I had kind of a whole sideline gig with that. And then as much as I could, I was pitching other stories. I did a big piece for the New York Times about food co-ops, like meal sharing co-ops in neighborhoods. And I was involved with one with my neighbors. So that was sort of the basis of it. And I talked to a lot of other people who were doing the same thing. Yeah, I did as much as I could. But yeah, I didn't have a ton of time to really develop a full writing career because of, you know, all the other demands on my time. But it was enough to sort of keep me reasonably satisfied.
What was going through your head, though? Were you like, oh, I'm going to quit in 6 months. It's time to move on. Because you'd made that decision when you were with Mario I need to do my own thing.
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't as tiring or taxing in any way. And I could see that anytime I might start to feel a little bit that way, like, oh, I'm, you know, I'm kind of selling myself short. I'm edging close to my 40s and I'm still an assistant. I think Tony was aware of that too. I mean, he knew I wanted to be a writer. He knew I had ambitions beyond being an assistant. And so I think he was really strategic about giving me better and better opportunities to keep me on the hook because I was good at his life, you know, and I was able to make his life a lot easier. So, and I know that now, having talked to our agent, you know, she was his agent and eventually became my agent. And, you know, that was a conversation that they had, you know, where he was really wanted to find opportunities for me so that I wouldn't leave.
How did you learn how to say no gracefully? Because I would imagine you just had to let a lot of people down all day long.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely language that I used over and over again, you know, and a lot of times it was really just a fact of, I'm sorry, you know, he's going to be out of the country. He's not available. I mean, that's, you know, it made it easy in some ways because I was telling the truth, you know, it wasn't like, oh, there's no fucking way he would do that, you know, festival and wherever. It was just like, sorry, he's just not available, you know? And he was really good about protecting his time when he was available. You know, he really made a big effort to spend time with his family. So even if he was available, he wasn't, you know? And I didn't need to get into the, you know, the long, I got better and better over time at sort of putting up a boundary, you know, because I think at first I would be really apologetic and explain in great detail where he was going to be. And, you know, at some point it's like, doesn't matter. It's nobody's business, you know? He's just simply not available. But yeah, I did that a lot. I definitely had to let people down a lot. And then when we got to say yes, it was really exciting because people were thrilled, you know? So he set a really good example too of putting up boundaries and, you know, really doing the things that were worth his time, that excited him, or that were hugely lucrative. You know, which is, I mean, that was sometimes that was the decision maker.
Got to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
Let's fast forward to the book.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, you sit down with Anthony to talk about this book. Can you tell us about that?
So, well, we published a cookbook in 2016, Appetites, which I think I spoke with you about
on the
show a couple of years ago. And that had gone really well. That was a really fruitful collaboration. And that was definitely the biggest opportunity he had given me to date. And I loved it. So then he came to me and said, you know, let's do another book.
You were full on the co-author of that book.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes. It was a conversation between me and Tony and Kim Witherspoon, who's now my agent, about, you know, here's this idea. We should do a travel book. And how are we going to do it? We were really inspired by Atlas Obscura had just published their big book. And we really liked the idea where they weren't encompassing the entire world, but just those really unique, special places in everywhere. So we wanted to try and use that as inspiration. Obviously, it's a very different book that we made, but that was a point of reference for us. And of course, you know, Tony had been not everywhere in the world, but many, many, many places, and many places more than once. So we had this great body of work to refer to. And so we had, you know, we had this one meeting that I thought was going to be the first of many, many, where I went in, I had a list of every place he had been for television. And we just went through and decided, you know, whether or not to include them. And then if we were going to include them, what were some of the places that stuck with him off the top of his head that really made an impression that he wanted to share with other people? So that became really the blueprint for the book. And unfortunately, that was the only meeting that we had because of probably 3 months later was when he died.
Wow. So you only had that one meeting to go on for this whole book.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a couple of emails. I'm sure. I mean, you know, as I was writing the proposal, there were some conversation. But really, you know, once it got down to it and the publisher agreed and we were, you know, set to go, it was really just that one. And I feel very lucky to have gotten that one. You know, I mean, he was so busy and this was in the spring. He had, you know, back-to-back travel and speaking engagements and a million other things. And I just happened to, you know, catch him at a time where we could take an hour and sit down and talk. So, yeah.
Tell us about the book.
So this is a travel guide to the world, according to Anthony Bourdain. And it is heavier in some geographies than others. Obviously, you know, it's probably 50% of the shows that he did were domestic. So there's a lot of United States in there, but there's also a lot of, you know, there's not every continent. He did go to Antarctica, but that's a hard thing to recommend to the casual tourist. So we left that out. But every other continent...
It's such a heavy book.
Yeah, it's dense. I mean, I think it's about 400 pages. I think of it in word count. So it's about 120,000 words, whatever that means to you.
That's a lot.
So it's got a lot of Tony in it. I mean, even though he was not around for the bulk of the time that I worked on it, I had access to everything he had written, everything he had ever said on camera, everything he had written for voiceover. And so there's a lot of rich depth of Tony in the book. You know, I mean, he was such a fantastic writer. He wrote all of his own voiceover for television. And when he was just speaking off the cuff on camera, a lot of that stuff was, you know, he spoke in full paragraphs, you know, with little side jokes and references. And so all of that is in this book. I really wanted to get as much Tony in there as possible. And even if there are words that you might have heard him speak before, it's different to read them and to see them put together to establish a sense of place for each of these many, many chapters that are in there.
Did you do the actual transcribing?
I did not. Fortunately, mm-hmm. 0.0, his production company, they had a very complete archive of all of the shows, and I was able to work with that because that would have probably added a year onto.
That's true. I'm a nerd about transcribing. Mm. I'm one of the few writers who likes to do her own transcriptions. But I was just curious, hearing his voice in your head that much. But I guess even just going through the transcriptions, you were hearing his voice.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious how hard that was.
I'd say it was not hard at all, really. I mean, if anything, it was very, very comforting. You know, I was also watching hours and hours and hours of old episodes, you know, most of which were available to me either through the production company or through the, you know, weird channels of YouTube. To get back to work on this book after his death, it was hard. I mean, it was difficult to pick up the pace. But then to have the privilege and the obligation to sit with all of his work and to reread things that he had written and to really kind of dive into his voice again felt like, I was saying this to somebody yesterday who was asking me, just a neighbor asking me about the process. And I said, you know, I sort of got paid to do the emotional work of grieving, you know, and it was profoundly helpful in the process, the early grieving process, to just be, to have Tony, his presence around me all the time, you know, and to feel like I was making something new out of the work that he had done. I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have this project and my job ended when he died. To have to go out and do something completely new would have felt like such a shock on top of shock, you know, but to be able to kind of gracefully taper out over the last few years with these projects has been, I think, really, really helpful to me in my own kind of emotional processing of what happened.
Yeah. How are you doing today?
I feel all right. It's not easy. This month, especially we're talking in June, and there's, you know, there's 2 days. There's the death anniversary that a lot of people take to social media and really remember him. And then there's his birthday, which has sort of become known as Bourdain Day. So there's, in the span of a month, there's these 2 days and, you know, I have to just take responsibility. And if it's too much for me, it's like, well, I do not have to be on Instagram today, you know? And mostly it's lovely to see people remembering him and paying respects and sharing their memories of him. But it is a lot, you know, it's very, it's just a very sad thing. You know, I mean, when anybody chooses to take their life and, you know, all the people that he left behind and, you know, the regret and the wishing that things had gone differently, I think, I told myself early on and anybody else that was kind of close to him that I was talking to, we had to tell ourselves, and I do believe this, that there's nothing anybody could have done. I mean, this is a decision that one person makes and, there's no changing it. There's no going back. And to sit and feel that none of us made this happen, and none of us could have predicted it. So it's, to add guilt on top of the shock and the grief is not helpful. But it's hard. It's surprising to me after 3 years that the grief kind of comes and goes depending on what's going on. There's this beautiful film that's coming out soon that really kind of brought a lot of stuff to the surface. And really just, I had a small part in the film. I was a consulting producer. The film is called Roadrunner. It's coming out in July. But I didn't see a cut of it until probably 2 weeks before the Tribeca Film Festival. And it just kind of resurfaced all that early grief. And it just kind of broke my heart open and really made me see what a lovable, flawed, complex person he was all over again.
Yeah. I had a hard time even watching the trailer and only met him once or twice, but thought, I don't even know if I can watch that movie.
Yeah. It is a tearjerker. Mm-hmm. I was glad to have seen it at home privately before I saw it at the screening, because it's a lot. I mean, they've done a tremendous job really, really showing you who he was and how complex and beautiful he was. Mm-hmm.
You know, you mentioned that when Tony passed, it also meant that you were no longer his assistant, but people have, for right or wrong, projected onto you and expected of you to be the keeper of the flame. Mm. How are you handling that? That's a huge role.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways it's nice, but I also feel like it's too big a responsibility for me. I mean, there were plenty of people who worked just as closely with him in different roles. The people that made television with him for, a decade or more, arguably knew as much about him and, were as deeply involved with his work or much more so than I was. So I'm uncomfortable being sort of that one person because I just don't, I don't represent the entirety of his work or his life, certainly. But that being said, putting out two books about him in 3 years definitely does sort of put me in that position. So it's complicated. I mean, I always try and this is something that I learned from Tony. If there's something I don't know, I say that, and I don't pretend to be the official historian forever and ever. I can answer questions and I can, point people to more information, but I don't want to be the owner of of his legacy because that's, he was so much bigger than me, so much bigger than any one person. And then there's also the question of like, how does this impact the rest of my career? So far it's been great. I totally recognize that world travel has done so well, not because of me, because of Tony, because of the attention that his name brings. But do I want to be the person that is, this might be the high water mark of my career, and that's a weird thing to accept, that I almost certainly will never have a book that sells as well and has, as much sort of commercial success and New York Times bestseller list. I mean, never say never, but this association with an extremely famous and beloved person that may be, as high as I ever achieve in some ways. But that doesn't mean that I don't still want to do my own thing. And I have to accept that if I write my own little book, it's probably going to be a little book, and I have to sort of be okay with that.
Let's wrap up on this book because we have a few more things to talk about. World Travels, it's a great book.
Thank you.
It seems like the perfect travel book for the internet age.
Yeah.
Because as you said, I can't remember if it was in one of the articles you wrote or in the intro, that this isn't the guide to how you cross Midtown via bus or get to some ferry or whatnot.
Right.
So what kind of travel book is it?
In the best case scenario, it would be All Things to All People, right? It's because there is a level of practical information in there. And some people have said, why did you bother to write so much about airports, And I get that. I think it's interesting. It's often the first point of connection for people with a country. And a lot of times there's a lot of interesting stuff that you can learn about a place. When was the airport built and what countries does, other countries are served by these airports? who is it named after? You know, how far outside the city is it? All these things. How do you get back and forth? Is there a robust public infrastructure that allows you to use public transportation? You know, I think there's a lot to be gleaned there, but
I'm a big airport nerd.
Right? I think
yeah.
it's
Are
I think
you?
There's I am. Yeah. I think it's so interesting. I want to know, you know, this it's an important part of the travel experience.
A bad airport is such a missed opportunity.
Yes. Yeah, and there's so much bad airport food, which is a whole other thing. There is practical stuff, but of course, like you can't go too deep. And so I do say in the intro, you know, definitely consult your local internet or, you know, or an actual travel guide, which, you know, they're still publishing them. I think that this is a book for people who really loved Tony and followed his work and want to reestablish a connection with his voice and, you know, read what he thought and felt about some of these great places that he went to. I think it's for people who are coming out of pandemic and are dying to travel, which is a lot of people. I think there's, you know, a lot of good ideas, jumping off points. You know, you've never been to Paris. Read what Tony says about Paris, you know, and how to use Paris and how not to run yourself ragged in Paris, just as an example. And then I think it's also for people like, I always give the example of my mom. She is physically handicapped. She's not going to be able to travel anymore in her life. She loved travel when she could, but she loves Tony's shows. They have them saved on their DVR and they kind of dole them out one by one. And for her, just to read about all of these places, just to, you know, understand the sauce on the chicken at the beach shack in Mozambique, or the you know, the train ride from Colombo to Jaffna in Sri Lanka. You know, all these little things that she won't get to experience, but she can experience them through Tony's eyes and through reading this book. So I think it's for travelers, and I think it's for non-travelers alike. And maybe you are a very seasoned traveler and you've been to many of these places and you can compare notes to what you've done to what Tony did. Or if you're going to go back, you can say, oh, I didn't know about that little place. You know, next time I'll check that out. So
how was it for you last year? You know, you're still grieving your boss. You have a child doing Zoom school and you are writing a travel book in the middle of a pandemic when no one can travel.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine what was going through your mind.
Yeah, it was a lot. Challenging for sure. At the same time, you know, I had planned to be kind of home and sort of on my own self-imposed lockdown in the time period that we were locked down, because I was finishing the next book.
Right, which we'll talk about.
And also doing edits on the travel book. So, you know, in a way it was like, well, I was going to have to sort of ground myself anyway in order to make my deadlines and to do a good job on this book. So I didn't find myself too out of sorts, but yeah, there was definitely a lot of concern about, oh, we're going to publish a travel book, you know, when nobody's going anywhere and who knows how long this is going to last. The timing actually ended up working out really well. It was supposed to publish in the fall of 2020. And then because of some production issues, it got pushed to the spring of 2021.
Fortuitous.
Yeah. I mean, we had the presidential election, which was taking up all the oxygen in the room. And COVID, you know, second wave and no vaccines yet. And I just don't think a travel book would have hit the same way that it did in April, when people were really starting to feel a little bit more hopeful about getting out into the world again.
Did you have any moments where you were like, oh my gosh, no one's ever going to travel again?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Because it just, you know, the way that people were sort of refusing to take direction and prolonging this thing was like, I you know, and then you see airlines struggling, hotels, restaurants, you know, the whole tourist infrastructure. I mean, and it has taken an enormous hit. I mean, things are back, but a lot of people have lost, you know, a lot. So it's worth noting that just because some people survived, not everybody did. And travel is different. I mean, I booked a flight to and from Syracuse with me and my son, and I just got a note from the airline saying, oh, we've made some slight changes. Now you've got to go through Detroit to get back from Syracuse. And I think it's the pains of getting these industries back up to full capacity. So yeah, it definitely was a concern. You know, I'm hoping for the best. I'm hoping that, you know, this new place that we find ourselves, you know, keeps the industry growing and recovering.
Let's talk about the second book that you referenced. This is a biography. Mm-hmm. I feel weird calling him Tony because he wasn't my friend, but I know all the people who love him call him Tony. Mm-hmm. So it's a biography about Tony, but it is an oral biography, which I love. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't know him, but I would imagine that he loved I, funnily enough, worked for a guy named Legs McNeil, who wrote Please Kill Me, The Oral History of Punk Rock. Mm-hmm. And Legs, you know, was just a legend in punk rock circles, still is. And then there was that great book, Edie, about, not Edie Falco, about Edie Sedgwick, who was part of Andy Warhol's gang. And George Plimpton did that oral biography. I think he had a co-author as well. Mm-hmm. I love oral biographies. So I was thrilled to see that this is an oral biography. And I was curious, are they, you didn't write a traditional biography, but but I would imagine they bring some unique challenges.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, as a writer, it was a relief to do it this way. You know, I think to have done all the interviews that I did and then try and, you know, flatten it down in a way into my own singular narrative voice, I don't think would have served the story. I don't think it would have served the people who had all these stories to tell.
Did you set out to do a traditional biography?
No, no. This was the idea was always to do an oral biography. You know, I think writing biography is its own very specific art, you know, and I, some people do it really, really well, but I would, this format really worked for me. And it allowed me to get to know a lot of people that I didn't get to know when Tony was alive. And I,
such as
Anderson Cooper, you know, who I had met once or twice, but I hadn't really had any meaningful conversations with him, and Christiane Amanpour and Kamau Bell and Josh Homme from Queens of the Stone Age, and Tony's mom, who I had never met before, and his brother, who I had never met before. And all these guys that worked with him in the 80s, in that period of time he was writing about in Kitchen Confidential, who had great stories and were people that I never would have met, you know, and then different kitchen colleagues from the 90s. And, you know, I knew I had relationships with a lot of the people that he made television with, but I hadn't ever, again, had the time to sit down and hear their stories about traveling and having all these adventures with Tony. So it was a real education. You know, I felt that I knew him so well and that I knew everything he was doing and where he was and why for a decade, but I learned something new about him from every single one of these interviews. So I think people who also, you know, followed his work closely, were big fans and read all of his writing will still find a lot to learn from this book.
Was it cathartic or healing, do you think, for the people you interviewed?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, some people shared that, you know, specific sentiment with me that it was really useful to talk about Tony, talk about their memories and kind of try and process, you know, what happened and who he was. So yeah, you know, and there were some people who didn't want to talk because it was too painful or because they just didn't want to revisit that time. But I was very lucky to get a lot of great cooperation from a lot of different people.
Is Eric Repair in
the
book?
He is, yes.
He is. Yeah. Yeah. Again, you know, I will eventually read the book, you know, because I have so much respect for you and I have so much respect for what Anthony did for the world of food and travel and journalism. But I just would imagine it's going to be a hard read.
Yeah, it's, you know, I try to keep it moving and it really does try and tell his story from, you know, birth to death. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of funny stuff in there, but there's also a lot of sadness and there's a lot of, you know, he surrounded himself with really smart, really empathetic people from all different walks of life, and to read the things that they saw in him years and years ago and their observations. And there's a remarkable through line of people understanding that, yes, he had the coolest job in the world. Yes, he was presented as a very cool guy, but, you know, at heart, he was shy and awkward and nerdy and very loving and a real romantic and all these things that don't necessarily telegraph, you know, through the adventure travel TV genre, but are very much part of who he was. So I think there's funny stories and it's a journey.
Yeah. Is it hard knowing that people will be looking for answers from this book?
I guess so. I don't think it has all the answers. I mean, I don't think we can ever really know what goes on in a person's mind truly, but I think that it will give people a fuller picture of who he was and how he saw the world and how he experienced things and sort of what his expectations for his life were. And I think in that way, there will be answers.
What was your biggest takeaway about yourself in the course of writing this?
I guess what I said before about thinking, even if you think you know somebody so well, that there's always more to learn about them and that, you know, your perspective is just that. I mean, it's that kind of Rashomon thing. And there are cases in the book where you see, you know, events relate in different ways, you know, different truths depending on who they're coming from. And yeah, so I think it really reminded me that, you know, to take everything somebody says at face value is not always, you're not always, you know, arming yourself with the absolute truth. And maybe there is no absolute truth, but that there's always something more to the story that somebody is choosing to show you or not to show you.
What is next for you?
Well, I have just started working on a bread book with a chef in Copenhagen, Richard Hart, who has a place called Hart Bakery or Hart Boggery, I guess they say in Denmark. So I am shortly about to go to Copenhagen for the first time, and I'm going to work closely with Richard and see how he makes bread. And we will be publishing that, I believe, in 2023.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah.
That'll be a nice break for you to go somewhere completely different.
It's a real change of pace for sure.
Will your son travel with you?
No, he is going to theater camp and baseball camp. So
I love it.
Much more fun for him.
And you'll be going to Syracuse at some point. We've established that.
Yes.
Yes.
We're doing a fishing trip on Lake Ontario with my dad.
So fun.
Yeah.
All right. And how about, are you still writing? Taking general assignments? Asking for a friend?
I haven't taken too many just because it's been a whole second job of promoting world travel. And now I'm, you know, starting to head into the promotion period for Bourdain, the definitive oral biography. So I haven't really had a lot of time, and I've tried to be better about not overloading myself. I used to just say yes to everything and then be subsumed with regret over having said yes to everything. So I'm trying to be a little nicer to myself and give myself time to do things, a couple of things well versus, you know, 20 things not that well. But yes, very much, you know, I'm very interested in writing. I got the opportunity to do a few assignments around world travel. I did a thing for Vogue Australia about traveling with Tony. You know, and once this book is out in the world, the second book, I will have more time to do that kind of thing. And I'm starting to work on my own little project, you know, telling my own stories from my time working with Mario and working with Tony and maybe some childhood stuff. And, you know, I don't know if it's a memoir or if it's a book of essays, but it's something that's really from my perspective.
I love that. What is your thing? Like Tony's thing was travel and restaurants. What's your thing? Like, what do you love doing, writing about?
That's a good question. You know, I've been writing a lot about relationships and, you know, sort of what it was for me to be a girl in the 80s and a college student in the 90s and, you know, what the expectations are of women taking care of men. I mean, that's a very specific, unique viewpoint. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not unique. Like, I think it's actually quite universal, but it's really just from my perspective you know, how that impacts a person, how you make decisions, you know, to get partnered or to not be partnered. And it's quite personal, but, you know, having been married and divorced and I think there are some things that I wish somebody had told me as a young person so that I could make smart decisions because I made a lot of dumb decisions.
I always think the same thing about myself, but I don't think I would have listened.
Yeah, that's true. It's true too. I mean, I know I made the decisions that I made with the information that I had.
Right.
And I don't necessarily regret anything, but I see how, you know, the larger culture made me feel kind of forced into a couple of small boxes when the truth is there are a million boxes.
Absolutely. Lori Willever, we're going to do a little speed round and get you out of here.
Okay.
Last pantry purchase.
Whole wheat flour.
I guess, are you getting ready for your baking book?
Yeah, I've been trying to develop a very strong starter. It took me a couple rounds.
A lot of flour in the Willever household.
So much flour. Yeah.
Favorite or most used kitchen tool?
Chef's knife. Every day, all the time, multi-use.
Do you have a brand you love?
I have a Global that I really like, but I will say I got it in a swag bag at a party several years ago. So it just, you know, I didn't make some sort of deliberate decision, but I really love it. I love how lightweight it is and it's very easy to sharpen.
Music in the kitchen. Yes or no?
Yes.
And what do you listen to?
Right now it's a lot of Nico Case and Courtney Barnett.
Oh, I love Courtney Barnett.
So good.
footwear of choice in the kitchen?
Bare feet.
Oh, yeah. I think you're the first one to say that. I do bare feet too. And then I drop the knife and yeah. I'm like, oh, whoops.
I know it's not safe. I'd say clogs, but I have terrible feet, so I can't have anything that has any kind of an angle. So, you know, just heavy duty sneakers.
But yeah.
Bare feet, really. Let's be honest.
I mean, really, what's the difference between Converse and bare feet? Nothing.
Right.
Tiny sliver of fabric. Mm-hmm. Okay. Oldest thing in your fridge?
Ooh. I have some hot sauce that I got when I moved into my current apartment, which was 3 years ago, that I haven't opened yet and maybe never will.
Most treasured cookbook or a treasured cookbook. You probably have a lot of cookbooks.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one. Well, can I say Appetites?
Sure.
I think it's great. I use a lot of the recipes because a lot of them are my recipes. So Appetites.
There's no shame in loving your own
promo.
No shame in loving your own cookbook. I still love the Cherry Bomb cookbook and cook from it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A dream travel destination. Now that you wrote a whole travel book, mm-hmm. where would you like to go?
Mm-hmm. Oh, great question. I would like to go back to Vietnam. I only went to Hue in the central part of the country, and I know there's a lot more there. I'd love to go to Ho Chi Minh City. I would love to go to Hanoi, and I would love to go up to the mountains.
This question's a little bittersweet because we've been asking this one for a few years. We took a little break during the pandemic, but the question is, if you had to be trapped, we probably asked you last time, if you had to be trapped on a desert island with one food celebrity, who would it be? Oh. And the number one answer has always been
Tony Bourdain.
Yeah,
I would, you know, I can think of far worse companions. I know last time I said Padma. So I'll just go with the crowd and say Tony, because I would love to be able to spend time with him again. I have dreams about him quite frequently, and it's always really, really nice to see him.
What do you dream about?
Lately, it's been like minor struggles that I'm trying to help him with, you know, like get his phone working or get tickets to a certain movie, or there's just like an annoying problem that we can't quite solve. And so, but other times it's been, you know, he comes back and it's like, oh, it was all a big misunderstanding. And okay, I'm back. Let's get back to work.
Oh, you're going to make me cry.
Yeah. So I think it's very normal, yeah. You know, to have these kinds of dreams about people that that left far too soon.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, Lori, we're such big fans here at Cherry Bomb. And thank you for putting all this beautiful work into the world.
Thank you.
And we're just glad you're here and you're a writer and truth teller and all those things.
Thank you very much. This was super fun. I love talking about myself.
Well, we love hearing about you.
That's it for today's show. Thank you so much to Lori Willever for joining us and sharing her memories of Anthony Bourdain. I still miss Anthony very much, as I know many of you do. So it's nice to know his life and spirit live on in Lori's projects. Be sure to pick up a copy of Lori and Anthony's book, World Travel, An Irreverent Guide, at your favorite local bookstore. Thank you to Cake Bread Sellers Wine and to Homemade, the podcast from the publisher of All Recipes, for supporting Radio Cherry Bomb. This show is a production of Cherry Bomb Magazine, which you can subscribe to at cherrybomb.com. And while you're there, I would love for you to sign up for our newsletter, learn about our podcast episodes like this one, and our other interviews with food world legends, including Nigella Lawson, Alice Waters, and Yotam Ottolenghi. Radio Cherry Bomb is recorded at Newsstand Studios at Rockefeller Center in New York City. Thank you to Joseph Hazen, studio engineer of Newsstand Studios, and to our assistant producer, Jenna Sadu. And special thanks to the band Tra La La for our theme song. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
I'll have what she's having.